That is Delilah by the great Clifford Brown and Max Roach. And we lost Clifford Brown on this day in 1956, so we remember him with his music. Let me introduce our panel. There's a lot to talk about here in the time we have. We're joined by Dr. Tabit A.J. Abdullah. Dr. Abdullah is Associate Professor of Middle East History and Associate Dean for External Relations at York University in Toronto, specializes in medieval and early modern Iraqi history. His most recent books are Dictatorship, Imperialism and Chaos, Iraq Since 1989, and A Short History of Iraq. Philip Bennis joins us. Phyllis Bennis is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of numerous books, including Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer. Dr. Adil Shamu is in the studio, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focused, author of Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace. Jay Bernstein is a board member with the Baltimore Zionist District and host of Shalom USA Radio. Good to have all of you with us.
Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning. And the number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Phyllis, it's good to have you back with us. It's been a while. Glad you could join us today. Let me start with you, if I might. There were headlines in an interesting article in today's New York Times. One headline was that Iran is now sending advisors and drones to aid the Iraqi army. And another piece that was in the New York Times today, which is kind of breaking news because they broke this story, that the panel came out about the use of drones. It was a bipartisan panel made of mostly intelligence officers and former military officers. And it said that the embrace of, and I'll read this from the Times, the embrace of targeted killings using armed drones risks putting the United States on a slippery slope into perpetual war and sets a dangerous precedent for lethal operations that other countries might adopt in the future, according to this report. And that, I think it was an interesting confluence of things here in this kind of very messy situation. What are your thoughts?
Well, indeed. I don't think we can say that the U.S. is approaching a slippery slope. The U.S. is well down that slippery slope towards permanent war. The problem that we see today with, on specifically the drone issue, and this isn't particular to Iraq, where only so far surveillance drones are apparently at work, but the U.S. is using drones to kill people in a host of other countries. Quite secretly, some in CIA programs that are officially denied, others in military programs. And that goes from Pakistan to Afghanistan to Djibouti to Yemen. There's a range of countries, Somalia, where permanent war is going on, despite the repeating over and over again from President Obama, from Secretary Kerry, from a host of members of Congress that say, there is no military solution. There is no military solution to the crisis in Syria, no military solution to the crisis in Iraq, no military solution to the rise of, quote, terrorism. We need to make that real. If there's no military solution in Iraq, sending 300 new special forces, 275 new military embassy guards, drone surveillance, and threatening airstrikes, for what? If we say there is no military solution, there is no military solution. I happen to agree with the president on this one. What needs to happen here is a shift from this militarization, whether it's drones or boots on the ground, or in the case of special forces, sneakers on the ground. I always think that's how they get around it. You know, no boots on the ground because special forces guys wear sneakers, you know. But we need to get past that and get real about what it's going to take for diplomacy. And I think this is a moment like Nixon goes to China. President Obama should go to Tehran. There should be negotiations immediately over the crisis rising in Iraq and certainly continuing in Syria. And then there should be a continuation of the nuclear talks, which seem to be going well, although they're almost certain to be delayed at the July 20th deadline. They'll be extended for another 6 months. But there needs to be the kind of grand bargain that the Iranians offered back in 2001 and 2002 when they were working so closely with the United States on the question of the overthrow of the Taliban in Afghanistan. Not for very good results, I would say, but nonetheless, they were working closely. And to say, this is the moment to resume those kind of talks. There will be enormous pushback from Saudi Arabia, from Israel, from supporters of both in the Congress and elsewhere. But that should not prevent the kind of outside-the-box, new initiative that's required at this moment of rising crisis where the U.S. seems able to respond only militarily, while saying over and over again there is no military solution.
So, Jay Bernstein, your thoughts on that? We also look at the news the news this morning that Syrian warplanes struck in Iraq. 57 civilians were killed in that attack. That's being reported by the CNN and BBC. And your thoughts on what you just heard Phyllis say, and also where we are. What should be the response be then?
Well, good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me on. In regards to what Phyllis said, I happen to agree that for many of these issues, there really is no military solution. It's a very complicated mix of issues to deal with and a very challenging moment for American foreign policy. However, I think there is a continuum here. And the fact there is no military solution doesn't mean that the United States should not necessarily be taking targeted military action where appropriate. And situations where there are bad guys out there, the fact there is no military overall solution doesn't mean the United States should not be taking steps to protect its own interests. That being said, there are very complicated legal issues involved, particularly when the United States is targeting people who actually happen to be American citizens. And I think that's a different set of challenges that need to be dealt with. Generally, though, I think, contrary to what Phyllis was saying, I think this president has, in fact, been demilitarizing these conflicts. There's definitely been a retreat, I believe, in American foreign policy, and not just militarily, but generally. But actions are taken, and where the world continues, and no matter what the United States wants to do or doesn't want to do, threats are continuing, and we see what's happening right now in the Middle East. So I think really what's really needed here is a mix of responses. There are situations where a military response targeted, narrow military responses might be appropriate. Diplomacy needs to be dealt with as well. But to say there's one particular way the United States should go, I think, is oversimplifying the challenges that we're confronting today.
So, Thabit Abdullah, welcome back. Always good to have you with us, Thabit. I also want you to lay out for us something here that I think is important, and we'll turn to Adil Shamu for his response to what Jay was saying. This is, as Adil said to me just before the show started, a very complex situation. It's a messy situation. It's one that you can't just parse out good and bad, this side, that side. And this complexity is why I think there's so much confusion about how to respond to whether you're inside of Iraq, whether you're sitting in Washington, D.C.
Yes, for sure. Throughout the time that you've had me come on your program, Mark, I've continuously repeated sort of a same mantra. That is, the West can do all kinds of things. You know, the other countries, they could help or make things worse. But the primary players here are, in fact, indigenous to the region. It is the Iraqis, and I've been involved to a very limited degree with the politics there, but it is up to Iraqis and the Syrians to really take the most important steps here toward resolving this. What is desperately needed in Iraq, and everybody's been calling about on this, it's not just in the West that you hear this kind of talk. The Iraqi papers are full, continuously full, of editorials, of reports, of interviews, all calling for a government of national unity and the need for very serious compromise with the various parties. This is not a Sunni versus Shia issue, even though it has taken on that coloring. It's a question of a group of people that have been in the opposition to Saddam Hussein's regime coming to power with a very vengeful attitude of attacking and disenfranchising all the elements and all the families and the groups and the tribes and the social communities that were seen to in any way be part of Saddam Hussein's regime. Without changing that attitude, there will always be resistance. And in a situation like Iraq, where the country is on a knife's edge, that resistance is going to take on very extremist forms. Now, the United States and Iran can help, certainly, the situation. The conflict between the United States and Iran has not been good for Iraq. Any kind of rapprochement, any kind of an olive branch between these two powers will certainly help in bringing about a calmer atmosphere in Iraq. Both Iran and the United States have backed certain parties, have used proxies to put pressure on their rivals, and this, of course, has deepened the conflicts, made reconciliation more difficult. So any kind of a peaceful approach between the United States and Iran will certainly help.
Adil, before we go to break here, there's some very specific things I want to come back to from what all of you have said. I think that there is because I think what everybody's outlining here is what we're facing here is the quandary is both internal within the nations who are involved in this conflict at the moment, how it was started by the West in many ways with our entry into Iraq in the first place, and what now, could there be a positive response from the West, a response from Britain and the United States that actually ameliorates and helps resolve the situation rather than fuels the fire? I mean, is that possible?
Well, as we were talking before also the show started, in medicine we have a term we say nature or nurture. It's part of the nature of Iraq reconstituted by after the U.S. invasion. We embedded in it like genes, you know, this is the nature. We embedded in it that Iraq will be weak, that the Sunni and Shia issue will be exacerbated. And a military, we reconstituted 600,000 security forces, but we gave them no air force and no true heavy equipment. So embedded in it, and then we selected Nouri al-Maliki. The CIA recommended his name, and Ray Crocker, I think it was at the time, selected him to be the prime minister. We know he is a very Shiite. He's from the Dawa party. And the Sunnis, we gave them cash to come to our side. And the minute we left, they no longer have cash. So we created this kind of potential conflict. And the nature of it, let me give you the parties who are there now. We have ISIL, who are murderers. We have the tribal leaders and their tribe and the Sunnis. Those are all one together. And we have former Ba'athist leaders, military, former military leaders. And those groups, they are not long-term partners. But at the same time, to me, is we can criticize Nouri al-Maliki, and I will criticize him to the hilt. I think he has shown sectarianism. He has shown thuggery. He did not give any help to the Sunnis. But there is no moral equivalency between ISIL and the former military men of Saddam Hussein to topple the regime and all other factions. I think we need to separate that those two are really not supposed to come to the table. It's very dangerous to start talking about the opposition or the rebellious as if these people are legitimate, democratic, and they could have a unity government. Unity government with other sects like the Sunnis and the Kurds, yes, but not with ISIL and not with the former military Ba'athists.
Well, we have to take a break here. When we come back, I want to explore with all of you how this can happen. I mean, because you're seeing the situation exploding now, and it's interesting to me that the two of you right now, Talbot Abdullah and Adil Shamu, two of our panelists who are Iraqi-born, both come from communities that are not in the majority.
That's right.
We both come from minority communities inside of Iraq. And so that's an interesting perspective. Bring this in terms of what Iraq could be. We're going to take a break, and what you're hearing is Stone Soul Picnic by the Fifth Dimension, because this is the birthday of Billy Davis of the Fifth Dimension, born on this day in 1938. We'll be right back with our guests. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and what you're hearing is A Wicked Game by Chris Isaak, who was born on this day in 1956. 56. Yes. And we are here with our guest, Dr. Tawhid Abdullah, professor of Middle East history at York University, author of most recently of Dictatorship, Imperialism, Chaos, Iraq since 1989. Phyllis Bennis, who is director of New Internationalism Project at the Institute of Project Studies, Policy Studies, author of numerous books, including End of the War in U.S. and Afghanistan, a primer, Dr. Adil Shamu, associate fellow of the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, and on Foreign Policy and Focus, Jay Bernstein, who is a board member with the Baltimore Zionist District and host of Shalom USA Radio. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So I'm trying to figure out from the four of you, as Americans are trying to put their hands around, what the future could be. I mean, you're in a situation now where I was saying during the break that Maliki has said he does not want this coalition government to be forced in him at the moment, that he would so that he's recalcitrant on some levels and making other noises, saying he might do something, but all the Sunni leaders have either been pushed out or arrested or in exile. Iran is supporting the Maliki government. It looks like they could send troops in any minute. They have tens of thousands of troops now on the border of Iran and Iraq, waiting to see what happens. The Kurdish Kurds are acting very independently, which is Turkey could see as a threat. The Kurdish rebels now, with the reports I was reading today from an Indian newspaper, was that Kurdish rebels are moving in northwestern Iran. And that's causing some tension there. And then you have ISIS in Iraq. So my question is, I guess, let me start again with Phyllis and then go to Tawhid. This is why it's so hard to think about what policy should be. It's gotten so complex. I mean, we can say we can negotiate with Iran, and America should negotiate with Iran. But then, of course, many Americans oppose and others in Iran oppose the theocracy. But that's the government that you're dealing with. So I'm saying there's a complexity here. And I think people just we know that what the mistakes were made in the past, but I think it's how you formulate what the future policy should be is the real dilemma.
Well, I think there's two parts to your question, Mark. And one is I don't really agree that we know what the lessons are from the past. I think the problem is we don't. What we're seeing in Iraq today is a direct, not a linked or whatever, a direct result of the U.S. decision to invade and occupy Iraq, where the first act was to destroy the military, send home all these guys with guns, most of whom were Sunni, and demolish the Iraqi government, the civil service, under the grounds of what was known as de-Baathification, where everybody who had joined the Ba'ath Party, overwhelmingly people who had joined because you had to get a job, were thrown out of a job, had no way to support their family, and suddenly, in the place of those institutions, as problematic as they were in many ways, we have the imposition of a set of sectarian-identified political parties that are supposed to somehow be a new kind of democracy in Iraq because they would represent all the different sects. That was the U.S. strategy. That was what Paul Bremer did when he established the occupation. So when we look at what we need to do now, we can't ever put that out of our minds as something that, well, that's in the past. How do we move forward?
Right.
The first part of the answer is we don't move forward. We get out of the way so Iraqis can move forward. We have done so much damage in that country. We owe so much in terms of reparations, compensation, that we haven't begun to consider because all of the money we're giving goes to more guns. We've just heard about reports of a possible new billion-dollar arms deal with Iraq. What we're seeing, despite President Obama's language to the contrary, where he says, we are not going in on the side of any one sect, any one religious identity, they are. They're going in on the side of a sectarian Shia government that is fighting against, and I think I have a somewhat different approach than, I see it slightly differently than Adil, although I respect the fact that as an Iraqi he has better ties than I do. But from what I'm hearing, part of the reason, a big part of the reason that ISIS is making the kinds of gains they are making is because they have won over people who don't like anything about what they stand for religiously or politically in terms of how they want to govern, their extremist, violent definitions of Sharia law, etc., but are even beyond the former Ba'athists. They're certainly in there. The tribal leaders are certainly in there. But a lot of ordinary Sunnis are supporting them, giving them political cover, probably in many cases other kinds of support, because the Maliki government has gone so far down this U.S.-imposed path of sectarian divides for Iraq. So the challenge that we face is enormous. That part is absolutely accurate. So I think we have to go through a set of what do we do. So first, do no harm. Don't send any more arms, money for arms, soldiers, troops, drones, bombs, etc. Second, call for and support an immediate arms embargo on all sides. As long as the outside powers are flooding the country with more weapons, talking about a unity government or anything else means almost nothing. Right now, that means pressuring U.S. allies, who are the main source of weapons and money to all these various sectarian militias. Third, engage with Iran to jointly bring some political pressure to bear on this question of ending the sectarian discrimination, ending the government violence against civilians, violations of human rights, and towards the creation of a government of national unity. Then start engagement with Russia and with other international forces to get the UN back in the business of trying to organize serious international negotiations around the Syria crisis, which is clearly now part and parcel of the crisis in Iraq. Those talks never really went forward, partly because the U.S. was so insistent on excluding Iran, didn't learn the lesson of former Senator, I'm blocking his name, who ran the Good Friday talks in Northern Ireland, whose lesson was...
George Mitchell, whose lesson was,
if you're serious about diplomacy, everybody has to be at the table. Not because you like them, but because you don't. Because if you exclude some groups because you think they're terrorists or you think they won't listen, you're giving them a way out. You're guaranteeing that the diplomacy won't work. And last, massive escalation in the help to desperate people. We're not talking enough about the people, the refugee crisis, the humanitarian crisis that is escalating in Syria. It's now escalating across Iraq. It's a desperate moment, and the U.S. bears so much responsibility for this. That even though the U.S. has contributed a significant amount to the Syria refugee crisis, it needs to double, triple, or quadruple that. So those are the beginnings of what we do, but it starts with do no more harm. Recognize the harm we have done to the peoples of those regions.
So I'll tell you about this. I want to go to Jay and Tava, but go ahead.
Well, I think U.S. should stay out. There's no doubt about it. Because beside the Iraqis, they have the largest interest. And the problem is their interest and their style and their policies are nefarious. They're not ready for the interest of the Iraqi people, contrary to what we claim. But there is a big component I think Phyllis and I forgot, and that is there is a huge partner with over $7 billion arms to the Islamist jihadists in Syria and in Iraq, and that's Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. And they are supposed to be our strongest allies. Why are we allowing our strongest allies to arm the terrorists, the ISIL group? And this is why I say it's we are nefarious. You don't hear much in the really establishment media in the United States about Saudis.
Right.
I don't understand why. And the Gulf states. Maybe they have a lot of money and people fear they may not invest in their company or something. But you're talking about billions of dollars and intelligence. And the reason they have that high intelligence is because every Muslim jihadist goes to Saudi Arabia for Mecca. And so they collect all the information. They know where they live and their addresses, as a matter of fact, a large number of them. So this is the problem. I mean, if we count ISIL as a legitimate revolutionary force, which I don't, okay, you are saying all the billions of dollars and the acts they have done in Syria and now in Iraq, it's okay, forgive them. You're right. A lot of revolutionary groups have small portion of them who commit crime, including some of them became prime ministers. But to have them officially recognized as a party, I would include all the tribes, all the Sunnis, but not the former Baathists and not the ISIL group because they have no interest. They want to take Iraq 1,400 years ago. Iraq doesn't need a group to be encouraged. like that.
But Tabit, like, just talk about how you, then before we go back to Jay Bernstein, Tabit, I just, again, I want to explore in depth here about what even the possibilities of a response are, given the level of dysfunction and crisis that exists from Damascus to Baghdad.
Yes.
And beyond.
Thanks a lot for this kind of question, Mark. You have to give me an impossible question to answer that. I'm not like your guests who are engaged very much in contemporary. I'm a medievalist, actually. But still, just by being engaged, I think that I agree with almost everything that's been said here, with the exception of three points that Phyllis made. First of all, I get a bit nervous when I hear, a lot of American progressives say, you know, we've gone in, we've messed up these countries, and now we should get out. I agree that one of the most important reasons for the mess that Iraq is in is certainly the American invasion and the policies that were followed even before the invasion. But America has a responsibility. They did get involved. I don't think it is even morally correct for the United States, for a new administration to come in and say the previous administration messed up, now I'm getting out, now, you know, the region has to deal with it. Now, I know this is not what Phyllis said specifically, but I get nervous when I keep hearing that America should get out, we should stop doing harm. Of course, you know, new policies, whatever, but American engagement is not only needed, and it is demanded by almost all the parties except for the extremists, not just the sectarian parties. Many of the liberals and the Democrats and the socialists and nationalists, they all believe that the United States should have a role to play, that it's important because it's powerful, but also because morally there's an obligation there. The second point that I disagree with Phyllis about is this complete moratorium on any kind of armaments. The ISIS group doesn't necessarily get its arms from officially recognized channels, and I do think that unfortunately there is still a role that needs to be played by armed forces. I mean, this group is absolutely ruthless. It's vicious. It's barbaric. I don't think that inviting them to the... I agree here with Adil completely. I don't think that this is a group that one can reach any kind of negotiations with, and I don't think they're interested, actually, in even any kind of negotiations. I agree with the point that Phyllis mentioned, that the ISIS group is not the representative of the communities that it now controls. It's much more complex than that. I also think that some of the former Ba'athists do have a role to play. They are actually representative of, as hard for me to admit this as you might imagine, I've suffered terribly from the Ba'athists, and my family has suffered, you know, innumerable pains. But I have to look at this squarely and admit that the Ba'athists are not just a small gang of mafia, a mafia family. Some of them are, but that many Ba'athists, in fact, represent wider communities, and there is a need for them to be engaged in this. How can this move forward? Internally, I've already mentioned, I think there's a need for a broader national unity government, a more conciliatory tone. The first step should be the removal of al-Maliki, and there is some movement in that direction by his very own base of support. I don't know if it will be successful. There's a lot of fear that removing Maliki will create divisions and weaknesses, and the country can ill afford that with ISIS sort of dangling a sword over everybody's head. But there are some movements in that direction. Secondly, I think I agree with Phyllis that I don't know if Obama needs to go to Tehran, but any kind of rapprochement between the United States and Iran will help. And I also agree with Ada that pressure on the Saudis and the Gulf countries is long overdue. It's one of the many scandalous forms of behavior that the United States is engaged in the region by sort of wrapping up these oil partners in cotton wool, lest they fear offended or something. They are a major source of a lot of this extremism. And also, it's amazing to me that there's no talk of the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, and the many demonstrations that go on there continuously by various groups focusing on the Shia community there that have been repressed ruthlessly by the Saudis. This also has to change.
So I'm glad you raised the issues you raised. Before I go back to Phyllis to let her come back to respond to some of those things and think about, we haven't heard from Jay for a minute. Let me bring him in to have his response to what he's heard, which may be a little different. I think we have about 12 minutes left in our conversation to let you all know where we are. Jay, you're on the air.
Well, I'm going to keep it brief because I'm not sure who the last speaker was, but I agree, with most, I agree with most of what he said. Just a couple points, which I'll reemphasize. I happen to agree with Phyllis as to why we're in this situation, and the fact is that I think the United States bears a lot of responsibility for engaging in Iraq, how we dealt with Iraq, and the situation we have today. To me, that's all the more reason why doing nothing is not an option. The way I view it is that given our responsibility for what's occurred and given the blood and treasure that's already been invested by this country in that area, doing nothing is not the right choice, either morally or practically. Now, what to do is an entirely different question. I'm not enough of an expert to say. I think it's a situation which is common throughout the area, throughout the region, where it's picking from bad choices. From what I'm reading, it seems like there's an attempt by the current Iraqi government to obtain the support of the United States to resist what's going on, to resist the rebellion. And perhaps that gives us some leverage. And it may be a situation where we're holding our nose in dealing with a current Iraqi leader who is very distasteful. But the options are even worse. And I agree with those of our panelists who talked about what this opposition represents. And, you know, this is a murderous group with no respect for human rights. And their goal is really to create, from what I'm reading, a Shia crescent. If we do nothing, the results could be destabilization of Jordan, destabilization of Lebanon, and more of a threat to the long-term interests of the United States. So we've got to determine a calibrated approach, but I think just doing nothing and letting things play themselves out is not the right option for the United States.
So, Phyllis, let me ask this one question before we turn to Adel. And especially one of the things that I think that Talbot was saying in talking about, one of the first things you said was no more arms, not being involved in that way in Iraq. And some of the pushback has been, well, ISIS is not a group that's going to negotiate. They're not a group that's going to sit at the table, that the only way to deal with ISIS is militarily or they will take over.
Right. I think that what I said was, first of all, what an arms embargo means starts with pressure on U.S. regional allies, starting with Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey and Jordan, who are providing arms to all those groups, including ISIS. Now, I understand it's not an official policy of the Saudi government, but there's wide-ranging reports of a bunch of Saudi princes who are involved, wealthy Saudis. You know, Saudi Arabia is a pretty, what's the polite term, a rather repressive society. There's a lot of surveillance.
Right.
The government, if it chose, could stop that flow of gray market and black market weapons. These are U.S. weapons, let's be clear, that the U.S. is selling to Saudi Arabia in the context of this $60 billion arms deal. And that could be stopped in the context of a real arms embargo. This is not easy, let's be clear. The politics of this are ridiculously hard because, among other things, it would mean getting the administration and Congress to say to the military producers in this country who are making a killing off of this war by arming all sides, They'd have to say, you know what? We're telling Saudi Arabia that if they don't stop allowing these weapons to go from Saudi Arabia to ISIS, we are going to cut off their access to U.S. weapons. That means we're going to cancel your contracts. That's not an easy call, let's be clear. But in terms of what should happen, we're talking morality here, mm-hmm. the moral thing starts with that kind of an arms embargo. I absolutely agree, and I never said, obviously, do nothing. We have a huge obligation, and that isn't only about money. It's about all these other things I talked about. The U.S. needs to lead on an arms embargo. The U.S. needs to lead on engaging with Iran to bring a new kind of pressure to bear to end the sectarianism of the Iraqi government that is leading to the reality on the ground where ISIS is succeeding, not because ISIS by itself is so strong, but because ISIS is winning support from Sunnis who are desperate. If the desperation stopped, their support for ISIS would stop. We're already hearing some reports about fighting between Sunni forces, informal Sunni forces, and ISIS.
I read about that, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, this isn't something that is unchangeable. And then the broad international negotiations that began to, there was a hope they would take hold around Syria, never really were allowed to, that needs to be broadened to include Iraq as well as Syria, and escalating the economic aid to the refugees, not directly to these governments that are doing it all wrong, but doing it through the United Nations. All of these are huge obligations of the U.S. Doing nothing is not an option, and I certainly didn't propose that.
So I'm curious, let me start with you in the 5 or 7 minutes we have left here. I'm curious about where we might see some light. Is there light in any of this?
Well, I admire Phyllis's optimism despite her opposition to all our U.S.
Absolutely.
Intervention in
yes.
Middle East.
Yes.
She's hoping the U.S. will push for something great and angelic. I am not as optimistic as that, and that's why I want to keep the U.S. policy, because the U.S. policy is so intertwined with the Saudis, with the Gulf state, with Israel, with Turkey, with the opposition in Syria, anti-Iran, all that is impossible, despite the fact that I really think President Obama, despite my all criticism, he is not as bad as John McCain, who wants to send the troops on bomb immediately. That's or the neocon. I think the reason I say U.S. should stay out, our hands are soaked with blood of 500,000 Iraqi death, a million wounded, 70,000 orphan, et cetera, et cetera. The country's been taken back decades in every aspect. So I think let the people of Iraq, if we provide some help, humanitarian help, that's good. But I don't expect the U.S. policy to change such dramatically where they're going to look for only the interest of the Iraqis in this conflict, because our interest has a primacy on our actions rather than the Iraqis.
I mean, we don't have time to do all this now, but part of the problem with dealing with American policy is part of the premise is the dangers of. The dangers of the attacks on the oil fields that fuel the economy of the West, where the majority of people living in northeastern Saudi Arabia and in the Emirates, where the oil comes from, as well as in Iraq, are Shiites. And so the U.S. has no idea what to do, but they don't want to lose, the West does not want to lose this access. And I think that's part of what's
I think I agree with you.
You know, that's part of what's fueling this, and I think that you all are correct. And I'm curious, Talbot, you said earlier, before we have to go, you said very, very quickly, I want to hear from you, that you've been reading a lot of Iraqi press.
Yes. So, by the way, one of the things I just read is that Iraq has just hit a record in terms of its the amount of oil that it is exporting. So apparently this is not having... not yet a negative impact on oil exports.
And this plays a huge role in what's going on there. And the other part we didn't talk about very much was the role of Israel plays in this as well, which is part of the reason that we didn't want to arm the Iraqi army in the ways you were talking about
That's
earlier.
Right.
We didn't get
That's
to
exactly
that.
That's exactly right.
But I'm curious very quickly. We'll come back to this next week with some of you, I hope. But Talbot, just in terms of what you're reading in the press and what it's from the ground up in Iraq, is there a sense of a hope, and there is of light from any of the stuff you're reading in Iraq?
Well, in addition to reading, I've been speaking to relatives, of course. Despite all of the analysis of what the United States has done and so forth, I have to tell you that when the ISIS group first emerged and swept through northern Iraq and began to approach Baghdad, the mood was absolute panic in Baghdad from everybody, both Sunnis, Shiis, and other minorities. There was absolute panic. For good or for bad, however you want to take this, when President Obama made a speech saying that the United States will engage, he sent in the aircraft carrier. Immediately the mood changed. That there was a sense that there's some hope that they can turn this around. So despite all of the, and I agree, the destructive policies of the United States, there is demand, there is a popular demand on the ground for the United States to actually assist in turning this around. Other than that, the press has been full, chock full. Now, of course, one of the good things that has come out is that we have a relatively free press in Iraq now, and the pro-Maliki press has been emphasizing the need to rally around the leader and the need for emergency powers to be placed in his hands. So there's an attempt on his part to use this crisis as a way of monopolizing even greater power. But almost all of the other presses, representing all of the various groups, are united in the call for a broader national unity government and for Maliki to step aside. So that's where that mood, that's where that's at. And I just want to emphasize that I
still, about a minute left, Hobbit.
Yeah. If the Iraqis can take some sort of a united front, I think that despite America's imperialist interest in the region, that they can still find some kind of a positive relationship with the United States. I think the key is national unity.
And I want to thank the four of you. This has been a brilliant discussion. I think it's been good for all of our listeners across this area and the country and the world who can listen to this to hear the caliber of discussion and the depth of this discussion. I appreciate the four of you for what you brought to the table here. Thank you, Dr. Tabet Abdallah. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Phyllis Bennis, always great to hear your voice. Thank you so much for all your analysis and work.
Thank you.
Adil Shamu, always good to see you, my friend in the studio. Thank you for coming in. And Jay Bernstein, I appreciate you coming in here as well on this program. And just a little quick personal note, let me say, as we go out of here, as we're listening to Gilberto Gil, this is his birthday, born in 1942, and Photograph Blues, one of his great pieces. I also want to thank Tabet and Adil personally as human beings who stood up to the dictatorship when they were in Iraq, but also as men who continue to fight for democracy and freedom around. Thank you all very much. Take a break. We'll be right back as we focus back in on Baltimore and where the jobs for our children. Stay with us.
Thank you.